Okay, our moderator for this program is Elizabeth Kelly from the EMF Safety Alliance.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's very nice to be here. It's really an honor for me to be on this program this afternoon. I have the honor of introducing the science panel, which will focus on the science of electromagnetic fields. But before I do, I would like to make an announcement. I'm formerly the, I'm formerly the Managing Secretariat for the International Commission for Electromagnetic Safety. ISIMS just published a book of 24 original studies that were done by scientists around the world. This book will be made available on the Internet shortly. The title of it is Non-Thermal Effects and Mechanisms of Interaction Between Electromagnetic Fields and Living Matter. It'll be released by the European Journal on Oncology under the Ramazzini Institute in Bologna, Italy, in cooperation with the International Commission for Electromagnetic Safety. This book includes 24 papers on biophysical mechanisms, cellular mechanisms, and tissue effects, in vivo effects, and epidemiology. Central to the theme of this book is a collaboration among scientists around the world to identify a basic mechanism of effect. This is very important. It's the reason why we have a thermal-based standard, because some of the scientists, the industry scientists, for example, say, if there's no basic mechanism of effect, how could there be a problem? We still don't know the mechanism of effect with tobacco, but we've taken action anyway. This book brings us further along. And this group is now working with Luc Montagnier, a medical doctor who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2008, a French medical doctor who discovered the cause of AIDS. And he's working with these scientists now. So this is a good development. And follow electromagnetichealth.org to find out how you can get your free downloadable copy. Now, I'd like to introduce the panel, now that I've caught my breath. Our first speaker on the science panel is Dr. Martin Blank. Dr. Blank is an associate professor at Columbia University, Department of Physiology and Cellular Biophysics. He's a researcher in bioelectromagnetics. He's one of the authors of the Bioinitiative Report and the section on stress proteins. He's the editor of the journal Pathophysiology Special Issue on Electromagnetic Fields that was published in March of 2009, and he's past president of the Bioelectromagnetic Society. Dr. Blank holds a PhD from Columbia University in physical chemistry and a PhD from Cambridge University in colloid science, an interdisciplinary biologically physics and chemistry department. Dr. Blank?
Thank you. I wish to speak to you as a scientist, and I will focus on the science. A lot of people talk about science, but not all of them are scientists, and many of the scientists who speak to you are not scientists in the area that they are supposed to be speaking about. I mean, you hear people, physicists, for example, will say that there can be no biological effects for non-thermal radiation. Well, the fact of the matter is they have not read the literature. I think one of the things you will walk away with after my talk is that there is evidence. You may not be able to evaluate it, but I'm telling you that this is evidence that's been published, it's been replicated, and it's been judged by scientists who are capable of judging it, that the electromagnetic fields of a variety of frequencies can cause biological effects, important biological effects, including damage to some fundamental molecules. And furthermore, that we have a fair idea of what the mechanism is. In other words, that there are ways in which we can understand how this can come about. And part of the answer to that mechanism comes from the evidence of the biological molecules themselves. because if you know the right language, the cells can tell you what they are doing. In other words, we can act as translators of the biology to tell you what the cell is trying to do. And that's the thing that we have been able to do. All of this evidence points out to the fact that what the standards that we have today are totally inadequate, and that as any reasonable person, and this is something where I'm taking off my cap as a scientist and putting on my general cap as a citizen, and that is that when you come across situations where you find that there is a potential danger, you try and avoid it. You try and avoid it before it becomes a real danger. This is known as the precautionary principle, and there's every reason to invoke that principle and to apply it in this case. Let me do a quick once-over lightly of EMF. Today we are focused on the red, the cell phones, and you see that's in the middle of what I have here is an array of frequencies, the spectrum. There are a whole bunch of frequencies that we know exist in nature, and some man-made, used by man. At the very bottom, we have the power frequency level. This used to be a point of interest about 20 years ago. Everybody was worried about that. Now it's shifted. We are now interested in cell phones and Wi-Fi, which goes up into the microwave range. And who knows what the interest will be next year? We keep on climbing up into the frequency spectrum because apparently you can transmit more information the higher the frequency goes. We come to that barrier there that's shown in dashed line, the non-ionizing radiation transition to ionizing radiation. This is the border that the physicists like to say, this is something where you cannot get any kind of reaction because there isn't enough energy in the radiation to knock an electron out of an atom. Well, that may be true. Not it may be. It is true. You cannot knock an electron out. But, boy, you can get a lot of biological reactions, and they have been published and repeated so that we know that you can get biological reactions in the non-ionizing range. And furthermore, when you go above into the ionizing range, you find that there are very clear changes that occur that are definitely detrimental to the human condition. I mean, you break up DNA, you cause cancer. People who have been exposed to the atomic blasts in Japan have developed cancers 40 and 50 years after they were exposed to the radiation, the gamma rays and the X-rays, so that not only do you get these effects, but they are long developing and you cannot see them immediately. The other point that I think is very important for us to focus on, and that is DNA. DNA is not an ordinary kind of molecule. It's the molecule that contains the genetic information that we have to keep us functioning. Most people tend to think it's only about passing on the information onto future generations. But the DNA is not like we were taught when we were, at least in my age group, when we were in high school, that the DNA is kept in the nucleus, very secure, locked in it, and it's hard to damage, it's chemically inert. No, that's not true. This molecule is in business, and it's constantly doing things because it makes the proteins that are needed for the business of life. And the way it does that is if you look in the lower center there, that double helix, which became famous when Watson and Crick discovered this as the basic structure of the molecule, that the ladder-like structure represents the chemicals that tie the two strands together, and these ladder-like structures are chemicals, these bases that contain the code. There are four different ones, and the sequence of the bases tells you what kind of molecule is needed for building the proteins that are needed for life. So that the code is in there, and this molecule is wrapped up in a long molecule that is about 6 feet long inside the human nucleus, and the nucleus of virtually every cell that we have. Now, one of the molecules that is made by the DNA is an indication of stress. I put this down that the cellular stress response. We all know that when an organism gets into trouble, there are special secretions. We know about adrenaline. We know about cortisol. These are things that are secreted by the body to mobilize so that you can run and that you can fight and you get your energy mobilized. That's true on an organismic level. But each cell has its own defense mechanism. And this is known as the cellular stress response. This is something that when a cell comes in contact with an unfriendly environment. An unfriendly environment is something where the temperature is raised, where the pH, the acidity, changes, and it's something that's going to endanger it. In other words, a condition that's not good for the cell to survive. It comes apart, the DNA in certain regions comes apart and starts to read the code to make stress proteins. Stress proteins are, there are about 20 of them in nature, and these are the ones that are used by the cell to counteract the bad effects of whatever the stimulus is in the environment that set it off. So that the stress protein is an indication by the cell in its own language that it has come in contact with something that is bad for it, that is potentially harmful. And what it's telling us is that when we know that the cell reacts to EMF in the environment, it is telling you that the cell feels it is potentially harmful. The cell has told us, you can do the experiment yourself, it will make stress proteins, and it only makes the stress proteins when it is in a potentially harmful environment, and it makes it with EMF. We have found that it makes it with EMF in the ELF, in the lowest frequency range. It makes it in radio frequency range. We know it makes it pretty much, well, it makes it pretty much over the entire spectrum. But anyway, let me point out the very last line in there, that cells react to EMF as potentially harmful. And that is the message that we get from cells. So there's no question about it. Another thing that you've seen already, because it really was an interesting piece of work, and that is that the work by Henry Lai and Narendra Singh, where they were able to show that if you bombard cells, the nuclear material will fragment. You get what are known as strand breaks. These double helix that I showed you that made that ladder at the bottom of that slide showed you that those strands break. And you can get single strand breaks. Sometimes you get double strand breaks. And these are the kind of damage that stress proteins react to, that they start forming. This is the data from published by Lay and Singh. There are also data from the reflex report, which has also been mentioned. So it's certainly been measured by a number of people. We come back to that diagram I started with the whole spectrum. And I've got a checklist. Here we've got the two effects that I've just mentioned. The heat shock protein, HSP, which are another name for stress proteins. These stress proteins are found pretty much across the entire spectrum, that you find that these heat shock proteins, my God, this X on the, somehow, it, on reading the slide, the X went out of the line, and it should be on the same line, because you should read that across, on the whole vertical line there, you find that heat shock proteins are made pretty much across the spectrum, up and down the spectrum. And the same thing with DNA breaks. The difference between these two measures of DNA damage is that the heat shock is made at a very, very low level of input. So if you're interested in what kind of damage can be done to the DNA molecule, the heat shock response tells you the lowest level that you can get a damage to the DNA molecule. In fact, it's a billion times lower than the kind of damage that's needed to activate the stress response with radio frequency. So this is a very sensitive kind of response that really tells you what is going on in connection with the response and that's potentially harmful. Another thing that you've got to realize is when you've got a response that is going across the entire EMF spectrum, this is a special property that electrical engineers refer to as a fractal antenna. Antennas is, maybe some of you are old enough to remember the old TV antennas. They used to come with the bars, and then they had a smaller circular bar. Each part of that antenna was tuned to a particular wavelength. And the wavelength that it picks up is determined by the size of the bar. Now, the DNA has a particular wavelength. It's six feet long in humans. But it picks up a whole variety of frequencies. How does it manage it? This is how it manages it. If you look at this double helix, starting from, that, again, that double helix that's in the bottom center, and you see it winding up, and you follow it along, it coils some more, and it winds even further. And then it winds again. You get this chromatin fiber that's formed. It just coils and coils and coils. And this is exactly the kind of property that enables the formation of a fractal antenna. By the way, fractal antennas are things that engineers love today because they can get a response to a variety of frequencies in a small volume. Everybody likes little cell phones that they can slip into their pockets. You can get an antenna that will respond to a whole variety of frequencies with the proper design of a fractal antenna. Well, Mother Nature has done that for us. We have a fractal antenna in the DNA, and unfortunately, it is responding to all the frequencies that are around us. And I think that is one of the problems, that we tend to focus on different frequencies at different times, but we're being bombarded by all of these things, and you never know which one is going to do the most damage. These are the different sizes of the coils that are in there. Again, there's been a shift on translation into another machine. Technology is not perfect yet. But the different coil sizes respond to different frequencies, and the DNA can respond to many EMF frequencies. One of the interesting things, some of you may be interested in the biology literature, people are discussing whether in early evolution we started off with an RNA kind of molecule as the basis for our functioning, or a DNA kind of molecule. One of the interesting things is RNA does not possess this property. RNA may have a big loop in it, but nothing like the kind of coiling that you have with the DNA. And DNA would lend itself to increased, what should we say, perfection, or increased adaptation to the environment by getting more and more damage done as it was exposed to the natural radiation that was part of the early environment in evolution. That's a side issue, but it's an interesting point about this DNA molecule. We have actually taken a piece of the DNA molecule that is responsible for stimulating one stress protein. Remember I said there were about 20 of them? We took one protein that is 70,000 molecular weight, HSP70 as it's called, and we analyzed the DNA. This long line, this horizontal line, is a symbol of the different parts of the DNA that are part of the promoter. This is the part of the DNA that gets activated to start the synthesis process. The red rectangles there are a particular configuration of bases. These are bases CTCT, and these are unusual in that these are the ones that are most electronegative, so they would have certain properties. They also they would respond to the electronegative means that they lose electrons more easily. They also respond differently to radiation. They lose radiation differently from the other bases. So we have analyzed this, and we found that the section that's known as the EMF domain, the large, big rectangle, controls the response to EMF. And when you have that, when you make a mutation in that, when you change that, the DNA in that, you eliminate the EMF response. When you take this chunk of DNA and put it into an artificial construct with a different kind of code in it, you can actually get an electromagnetic field to trigger that code. And this shows the kinds of results that we get when we have triggered that kind of code to stimulate other kinds of other kinds of proteins to be made. So you see that we actually have the piece of DNA that does this, and we can take that piece of DNA out and show that it responds to an electromagnetic field. Let me skip over this for the. We have a plausible EMF mechanism, again, that we've published on. You see the references there. That make a lot of sense because we've been able to show that when you have charging of a molecule, you can cause that molecule to come apart. We've actually shown a molecule coming apart. Hemoglobin, which comes in four pieces, can be made to come apart into two dimers, two-piece pieces, when you increase the charge on a molecule. And we've actually shown it in that system, calculated it through, and it's a very general kind of effect. Aaron Klug, who did this work with tobacco mosaic virus and the Nobel Prize work, showed this in the tobacco mosaic virus, that it's a matter of the charge on the molecule that causes it to come apart. We think that's what makes the DNA come apart. And the reason it comes apart is that the electrons that are present in the DNA bases can be made to move. And there are other groups that have shown that the DNA does have electrons and that they do move. There's a whole group down at the La Jolla labs in University of California here that have shown the electrical conductivity inside the DNA molecule. Now, I'm going to go through rather quickly a bunch, kind of an inventory, to show you that not only is there this kind of molecular thing, but there are all kinds of changes that occur with real tissues. This is a measure of the studies, the damage that can occur in nerves with possible links to Alzheimer's and autism. I noticed there was a question earlier about that. There are papers showing damage to the blood-brain barrier that protects the brain from noxious chemicals. And when EMF is present, you find that leaks and these materials come out and damage the cells in the brain and actually cause them to die. So there are links to damage to the brain, such as could explain Alzheimer's and autism. There's damage to sperm cells, which has already been mentioned. And the question of damage to cancer. The DNA damage is really something that has happened happens all the time, that DNA damage. And let me just look at the last two items in there, that people who are born with identical DNA, identical twins, if you measure them after they've been alive for a while, you find that the DNA is different. And if you measure the DNA in parents and children of autistic children, you find that they, too, have different DNA. There are enough changes in there so that there are changes that are occurring in life and that not all the changes are reversed. Now, the BioInitiative report we've heard of, but I'd like to end by just saying that we all live with risk and that as a result of not wanting to give up many of the things that we enjoy in life, we have to accommodate. And one of the things that living with cell phones and cell towers, we should develop precautionary standards. I think this is where the push must come. We must limit exposure, and I think if we do that, we at least stand a fighting chance. The other thing we must insist on is the testing of new devices, which is things that have just been allowed to pass into general usage without anybody checking to see what happens. I mean, just because we allow microwaves doesn't mean that Wi-Fi at the same frequency should be allowed to go into all the classrooms. And probably the most important part is the public education campaign. That is, people must be made aware of this issue. They must realize that even though they cannot see it or feel it, it's having its effect, and that these effects are cumulative, many are slow-acting, and that you really can't beat it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Blank. I just would wish we had more minutes in each hour right now. We need more time to talk. It's now my honor to introduce to you Joel Moskowitz. Dr. Moskowitz is the director of the Center for Family and Community Health in the School of Public Health at University of California, Berkeley. It is one of the 37 prevention research centers supported by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This center, its mission is to improve the health of families and communities. Dr. Moskowitz was recently involved in a review of 23 case control studies on mobile phone use and tumor risk involving 37,000 participants. The meta-analysis published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology in October 2009 found that the more robust study showed using a mobile phone for a decade or longer was associated with increased risk for developing a brain tumor. Dr. Moskowitz.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm going to summarize a review of mobile phone use and tumor risk my colleagues and I published a year ago, and then briefly review the overall results of the 13-nation Interphone study that was published earlier this year, examine cell phone use trends in the United States, and finally discuss public policy options my colleagues and I at UC Berkeley recommended in an op-ed that was published on April 28th of this year in the San Francisco Chronicle. I actually have 100 copies of this, but told that I'm not supposed to distribute them because it hasn't been pre-approved. However, if you ask me for it, I can give it to you. So if you want to designate, maybe you can ask me by raising your hand if you'd like a copy. Oh, okay. That's great.
Congress won't look at this until I'm done.
Or until we're all done. It pretty much covers many of the points I'm going to be making. A year ago, my colleagues and I published a meta-analysis of the epidemiologic research on mobile phone use and tumor risk. Meta-analysis is a quantitative approach that combines the results of studies that employ similar methods to look at the overall trends in the finding. The lead author, Dr. Myung, is an MD epidemiologist who visited us for a year from the National Cancer Center in South Korea. Two of my co-authors are here today, Diana McDonald and Jean Kasnitz. Our search of the literature identified 23 case control studies that contained about 38,000 participants. You might ask, what is a case control study? In a case control study, people who have tumors, called cases, are matched to people without tumors, considered controls, who are otherwise similar in terms of age, race, sex, and location. Then data are collected to compare the histories of the two groups to see if characteristics differ between them. The exposure of interest is past mobile phone use. A measure of association between mobile phone use and tumor risk is computed. This measure is called an odds ratio. An odds ratio of 1 indicates no risk, less than 1 means a reduced tumor risk, and greater than 1 means increased tumor risk for the mobile phone users. Case control studies cannot prove causation, thus they cannot provide conclusive evidence. However, this is the best method epidemiologists have to study rare diseases like brain tumors. Overall, we found no association between mobile phone use and risk of a variety of tumors, not just brain tumors. We also looked at cordless phone use, which showed similar findings as did the cell phones, at least in some of the studies that looked at cordless phone use. So that those are also of concern. This finding of no effect is what our government, the mobile phone industry, and many scientific advisory groups around the world cite when they state that the weight of the evidence shows, okay? However, we argue that not all the evidence deserves equal weight. When we graded the studies based on research quality and then sorted them, two distinct patterns emerged. In the high-quality studies, we found increased tumor risk for mobile phone use. These studies were mostly funded by government or foundation. In the low-quality studies, we found what appeared to be reduced tumor risk for mobile phone use. These studies were all or in part funded by the mobile phone industry. These studies had numerous problems that produced spurious results that were often dismissed by their authors in many cases. Brain tumors can grow slowly, taking decades to develop. So we looked at 8 studies that examined people who use cell phones for 10 or more years. Overall, we found 24% increased risk of brain tumors. Here, too, the four high-quality studies found higher risk, 54% increased risk for the cell phone users. These studies were conducted by Lennart Hardell and his colleagues in Sweden. In contrast, the four low-quality studies found no risk. These were part of a 13-nation study called Interphone that was funded by the World Health Organization and the mobile phone industry. So what did we learn from our meta-analysis? The high-quality studies found increased brain tumor risk, especially among people who use cell phones 10 or more years. We need more research to examine some key issues, including the effects of cell phone use longer than 10 years, because brain tumors can take 4 or more decades to develop, the effects of cell phone use among children and teens, because their developing brains are more vulnerable, more recent patterns of cell phone use and newer technologies, because these studies were done basically through 2004. And we need to look at other tumor sites besides the brain, especially the salivary glands, where there's been some evidence of risk in Israel, and near where the phones are held, right, and reproductive organs near where they're carried, essentially in your pocket. Earlier this year, the 13-nation Interphone study published overall results for two types of brain tumors, meningioma and glioma. Meningioma is a tumor of the outer covering of the brain. Although it is generally non-malignant, it can be fatal, and it often is. Glioma is a tumor of the glial cells, which surround the neurons. It is the most common type of brain tumor and is generally malignant or cancerous and often fatal. The Interphone data were collected between 2000 and 2004. The average amount of cell phone use was very light back then compared to today, less than 100 hours of lifetime use. So the results underestimate tumor risk for current cell phone users. There were numerous technical problems with the study, which the authors admitted biased the results and reduced estimates of tumor risk. And I think Lloyd Morgan may discuss that in more detail. After the investigators corrected for study bias, meningioma risk was not associated with cell phone use, even heavy use. In contrast, heavy cell phone use was associated with 40% increased glioma risk. This increased risk held up in 44 different analyses. They made all kinds of different assumptions and redid the analyses to try to eliminate certain kinds of biases, and the results held up. They were robust. Moreover, the increased risk grew to 82% after the investigators corrected for study bias. However, this latter finding was buried in the second appendix of the paper, which appears only on the website. And there's a preface to that section where they try to make you dismiss this table altogether. Some of the authors didn't even want this table to see the light of day, from what I've read on Microwave News website. A dose-response relationship was found for glioma risk with increasing years of cell phone use in an analysis that corrected for study bias. In this analysis, 10 or more years of cell phone use was associated with more than a doubling of the risk of glioma compared to less than 2 years of cell phone use. The authors of the Interphone study reported the study was inconclusive, which they probably could have said before they ever did the study, because all case control studies are inconclusive, although this one was probably more inconclusive than most for a variety of reasons. However, a few of the original investigators have begun to warn the public about how to use cell phones safely. This chart compares Hardell's results for 10 or more years of mobile phone use with results from the 2010 Interphone study after correction for study bias. Acoustic neuroma is a tumor of the nerve that connects the ear to the brain. Hardell found almost a tripling, three times the risk of a tumor. Interphone is yet to report these results. I've written two of the lead investigators, and they said they're working on it. At least one of them said. The other one didn't respond. And yet, it took them 6 years to publish this paper after the completion of the collection of data. So something strange is going on, I think. For meningioma, Hardell found 50% increased risk for 10 or more years of mobile phone use, whereas Interphone found no increased risk, even after adjusting for study bias. For glioma, however, both Hardell and Interphone found more than twice the risk for those who use cell phones 10 or more years. So we have consistent evidence from two independent sources of increased glioma risk among long-term users of cell phones. This chart shows the increase in cell phone subscribers in the U.S. from 1985 to 2010. As you can see, virtually everyone in the U.S. currently uses cell phones, including two-thirds of children over the age of 7. The average number of hours of cell phone use is now clearly many times greater than that being used in the studies we reviewed. In fact, the average user will fall into the Interphone study high-use group, which was 1,640 hours of lifetime use, within 14 years of first use. So the average user in the U.S. Should have roughly twice the risk of glioma after 14 years of use. There are about 6 gliomas per year in the U.S. for every 100,000 people. So doubling this risk means that individual risk is still going to be fairly small. However, from a public health perspective, this translates into 18,000 potentially preventable brain cancers per year, just looking at the glioma data and the current estimates. Nonetheless, people shouldn't panic because their individual risk is still fairly low. It's not a message you want to put out there necessarily, but I think it's important not to overplay the data. This estimate also may be conservative because over the longer term, especially among those who began using cell phones as children, we are likely to see even greater brain tumor risk. So what should we do, given that we have highly suggestive evidence that much of the population is or soon will be at increased brain tumor risk due to cell phone use? That first top one didn't come out right. It's a slide from the FDA which says no evidence linking cell phone use to risk of brain tumors, which was their summary, headline summary for the Interphone study. The National Cancer Institute had almost the identical headline. If you read down further, it'll say something about no conclusive evidence, but the headline leads you to think there's no evidence. This is our federal agencies. So our federal administration has taken a denialist position and tries to allay public fears by arguing we have no evidence or no conclusive evidence of risk. The Congress is concerned about this wait-and-see stance, especially after the death of Teddy Kennedy, and has held hearings but does not have sufficient votes to adopt legislation, in part because the mobile phone industry, like many other industries, has enormous political influence over our policymakers and regulators. Industry tries to maintain the status quo by repeating the conservative wait-and-see statements issued by government agencies and scientific advisory bodies. In 1996, the federal government adopted safety standards, I believe they were recommended by the industry, that cell phones must comply with. The standards assume that heat is the only way a cell phone can harm you, which we now believe is false. The phones are tested to meet safety standards using a simulated head from a 200-pound adult male spending 6 minutes on a phone call. It also assumes that the phone is not directly against the head. Thus, the federal standards seem wholly inadequate based on who uses cell phones today and how much they are used. The mobile phone industry publishes warnings about maintaining a minimum safe distance between you and your phone, usually 5/8 inches or 1 inch. But these warnings usually appear in small print with obtuse language buried in some of the user's manuals which people never read anyway. My research colleagues and I invoke the precautionary principle and call for precautionary health warnings and safe use recommendations. We also appeal to government for updated safety standards and more research funding. Wait a minute. I'll go on. The right to know button, by the way, was warned by activists at a hearings in San Francisco, which resulted in the adoption of the first U.S. law to require that cell phone radiation levels be displayed at the point of purchase. The industry has sued San Francisco over this legislation, as well as pulling its conference from the city. And that may be serving as a deterrent from many other cities that are now considering similar legislation. So if there are any pro bono lawyers in the audience or lawyers who want to do some pro bono work on this, I think they can be put to good use in working with some of these cities. Just let one of us know. In fact, I know they can be put to good use. What is the precautionary principle? The principle is an approach to risk management that justifies preventive measures or policies despite scientific uncertainty about the risk of harm. In 2003, San Francisco became the first governmental body in the U.S. to adopt this principle for environmental policy. The European Union and many nations adhere to this principle. I'm close. Health agencies in 12 other nations have issued precautionary health warnings about cell phone use. Many of these warnings focus on limiting cell phone use, especially among children and youth. Here is an example of a precautionary health warning from a bill presented to the state legislature in Maine by Andrea Boland earlier this year. The industry lobbied heavily and defeated the bill. Research suggests there are many potentially harmful effects of cell phone use on human health besides tumors. We need much more high-quality research conducted completely independent of industry. If we continue to engage in denialism and groupthink, I fear we will suffer the consequences either in our time or in the future. If we assessed $1 per year on each cell phone, this would generate $290 million annually. 8 cents per month will generate that much per cell phone. This fund could be used to publicize precautionary health warnings and safe use recommendations, research effects of electromagnetic radiation on health, and promote development of safer technologies. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Dr. Moskowitz. Before I introduce our last speaker for this panel, I'd like to make an announcement. If you have any questions that you would like to have answered at the end of this panel, if Bill Grant's around or somebody could pass out the little slips of paper we used the last time so you could, Camilla has them up here, and someone will collect them and bring them up to us at the front here, and then we'll have a Q&A period following this last speaker. I also wanted to say I was aware that Senator Boxer was going to be sending somebody here today. Is she here? Okay, Megan Miller, thank you so much for coming for Senator Boxer. And also Assembly Jared Huffman from Marin, Sonoma County, State Assembly Huffman, his assistant Jenny Calloway. Is she here? Jenny, hello. This is wonderful. I'm very glad you're here to hear this program today. I'd like to introduce our last speaker. Lloyd Morgan was the lead author of the Cell Phones and Brain Tumors 15 Reasons for Concern report. He's the Senior Science Fellow for the Environmental Health Trust, a member of the Bioelectromagnetic Society. Lloyd is a retired electronics engineer with 38 years of industrial experience. He's also a brain tumor survivor. He's co-authored epidemiological papers, and he's also, he's also the author of a paper estimating the risk of brain tumors from cell phone use, published case control studies, published in Pathophysiology in August 2009. Mr. Morgan?
What does the science tell us? Well, before we go there, what does industry tell us? The weight of the evidence says there is no problem. This is not true. Industry studies and the weight of the evidence says there is a problem. There's no known mechanism implying the data must be wrong. Oops. Probable mechanisms exist, but requiring a mechanism is anti-science in itself. First comes the data, then decades to centuries later, mechanisms are understood. There's no known mechanism for smoking and lung cancer. With so many cell phones in use, if they were causing brain tumors, then we should see an increase in brain tumors, and there is no such increase. It's true. There is no increase in the incidence of brain tumors yet. But the average latency time for brain tumors is 30-plus years. The question to ask is, what percent of all people were using cell phones 30-plus years ago? So tumor risk from cell phone use. We have brain cancer, acoustic neuroma, which is a tumor on the acoustic nerve, meningioma you just heard about, it's the lining of our brains, the meninges. Salivary gland tumor, particular one is a parotid gland tumor. Uveal melanoma is an eye cancer. Testicular cancer. But there were survivors, and there's been a study group for many, many, many years since. And they found many increases of cancer, but it took a long time. There was no increase in brain tumors until 40 years later. What does the science study for human studies? Joel has told us all about case control studies, so I'm going to skip through this really fast as to what they are. So there are six early studies. Five of them are industry funded. They were too early to expect a risk. Typical use was less than 3 years. Why would they do that? Because you can't find a risk. There are Swedish studies you've already heard about without industry funding. They're headed by the Hardell team. They looked at cell phones and cordless phones. Cordless phones are really also cell phones. And then there's the Interphone study, which you've heard a lot about. It had substantially industry funding, 13 different countries, but not the United States. Defined a user as somebody who used a cell phone for once a week for at least 6 months. Now, would you find lung cancer if you smoked one cigarette a week for 6 months? They only looked at cell phone use, but they asked every subject if they used a cordless phone use. If they use a cordless phone. And more subjects use cordless phones than cell phones. So what did they do with that result? They treated the cordless phone as a non-exposure. So they have a systematic underestimation of risk. You've seen that already. Here's the Hardell studies for children. If you start using a cell phone, and that's the important thing, when do you start? As a teenager or younger, you can see dramatic increases in brain cancer. This is more than 1 year of use. At the same time, you can see the numbers for adults. Children are far more at risk from all carcinogens than we adults are. They looked at high-grade brain cancer. I mean, brain cancer is pretty nasty. High-grade brain cancer is even far, far worse. What did we find? For every 100 hours of use, your risk increases by 4%. And for every year of use, your risk of high-grade brain cancer increases by 11%. Every year. They looked at use on the same side of the head. And you can see for cell phones and cordless phones, 130% or 100% increased risk of brain cancer. They look for greater than 10 years of use and greater than 2,000 hours of use. And you can see we have large increases in both cases, virtually identical for 2,000 hours or greater than 10 years of use. The Interphone study's underestimation of risk, we've already heard about. In their own paper, they said, well, it's at least 19% underestimation, but somewhere between 6 to 30% at 95% confidence. However, they also added the protective effect could result from the sources of error discussed above, although the magnitude and effects may not account fully for the observed reduction. Even as they're saying this is their underestimation, this still doesn't account fully. We published at a conference in Korea last year called Reevaluation of the Interphone Study Application of Correction Factor, and showed that there's a 25% underestimation of risk with a range between 11 and 47% underestimation. So what does the Interphone study found? Well, they did the pooled results from all 13 countries. They found no overall risk when the median use was 2 to 2.5 hours a month and 100 cumulative hours of use. Now, you that are cell phone users, just think about how many hours a month you use a cell phone. But with longer-term use, the Interphone study found 118% increased risk for greater than 10 years of use compared to very short users, that is 1 to 1.9 years. The systematic underestimation of risk, the most common finding they find for less than 10 years is using a cell phone provides statistically significant protection from a brain tumor. And they had 32 separate results showing this in the study. So let's compare Hardell versus Interphone studies. Whoops. Okay, 290% increased risk of acoustic... Okay, so going back to that one. what this doesn't show, but you basically have a much larger, I'm not sure why it didn't show up, a much higher risk from the Hardell studies, much lower. You can sort of see it by the placement of these images. I don't know if that industry funding had anything to do with the difference. We also have other tumors, 290% increased risk of acoustic neuroma, and it's an interphone study for greater than 10 years of use. 380% risk of meningioma for greater than 1,600 cumulative hours of use within 1 to 4 years of cell phone use beginning. Again, an interphone study. Now, appreciate, all of these risks are larger than that. An 81% risk of parotid gland tumors, the salivary gland tumor. Again, this is the Israeli study, more than 1,035 cumulative hours of use. Salivary gland tumors have tripled in Israel, and Israel is the single heaviest cell phone user in the world. 20% of the salivary gland tumors are under the age of 20. Here's a picture of our salivary glands, and you can see the parotid gland is the big gland in your cheek, which is where the cell phone is. Risk of other tumors. 320% increased risk of uveal melanoma, an eye cancer. Probable to certain exposure to mobile phones, said the study, which was by Stang et al. In Germany in 2001. 80% increased risk of testicular cancer. If you put it in the left pocket, it's your left testicle. If you prefer, you can put it in the right pocket and get it on their right testicle. In other words, this is that same, on the same side where you use a cell phone is where you find the tumor. The risk to male fertility. The Cleveland Clinic, among many others, have shown serious problems. Sperm count degradation and surviving sperm itself is degraded. And there are some slides on that, but they somehow disappeared. But let's just say that the concerns of these studies is even the surviving sperm is substantially damaged. So animal studies and cellular studies. We've already heard that Henry Lai found double-strand breaks after 2-hour exposure in DNA and blood-brain barrier leakage in rat brains after 2 hours in another study. They also found as a result of the blood-brain barrier leakage there was dead neurons in the rat brains. And before they sacrificed in the vocabulary of the science, the rats, they also put them through cognitive studies. They had been trained how to find food and work very quick and easy to find it, but after having cell phones, they had a hard time finding the food. We have human cellular studies that were in many, many European countries. This is that famous European reflex study. It's an acronym. Multiple replications. It wasn't just one lab. It was everywhere. GSM is the second generation phones, the ones before smartphones, and genotoxicity is telling us that essentially the genes are damaged. When you look at the UMTS modulation technique, which is the smartphone technique, you find it's 10 times larger at the same power levels. I'm going to skip past some of the reflex studies, but let's just say that there's a dose-response relationship. There's a risk per hour of use. You can see here there's almost no risk for the first 4 hours, and then by the time you get to 16 to 18 hours, it's dramatic. What does industry tell us? All agencies says there is no problem. The World Health Organization, Food and Drug Administration, Federal Communications Commission, and, of course, the National Cancer Institute. Regulators are controlled by the corporations they regulate. Any of us that are American citizens already know this. The World Health Organization has an EMF project within it, and guess who funds it? The industry. And they're the ones that report this. The FDA, it requires pre-market safety testing of all electrical devices held to the body, but they granted an exclusive waiver to the cell phone industry that they didn't have to do that. And the waiver champion within the FDA right afterwards went to work for Motorola. They approved Vioxx, which they, when they had data ahead of time showing that it caused the increased risk of heart attacks. There was an enormous amount of heart attacks. Merck, the manufacturer, pulled it from the market, but the FDA had never acted, even after there was weeks and weeks of reporting of all these heart attacks. Who's in charge, regulators or industry? The FCC. Exposure limit based on false industry premise that the only biological effect from cell phone radiation is heating. It only protects against cooking the brain, and it's guaranteed it will not cook your brain. The industry designed a cell phone certification process that substantially underestimates the cell phone risk for children by 2.5-fold. And the NCI did a study that the researchers refused, that were protested that it shouldn't be done because it's too early, but they went ahead and did it. So with human studies, animal studies, cellular studies, all showing serious health effects, what more is required before our public health agencies act? Thank you.
Thank you, Lloyd. Mr. Morgan, thank you. Well, look at all the questions we got. So I'm deferring some of them. There's another one about ready to come to the front. I don't know whether I'll be able to answer your question right now, but what I want to do is I sorted through and found seven that I thought were key to this panel that I think have general interest. There are a lot of questions on what to do about this. As a government official, what can I do? That's a good question. What can we do about the science? What can we do about getting President Obama's attention on this matter? Well, right now we're just going to talk about a few science issues that were raised in this panel. My first question is a general exposure question. I don't have a cell phone, but I live in downtown San Francisco. Aren't the EMFs all around us? And how do I protect my health? Also, from the electronic devices in my home. Who would like to take that one? And please keep your answers brief.
Essentially, I don't think there's any practical way to help yourself, except maybe run. We are living at a time where there's a rush to all things wireless. It's a form of madness. And until the public really raises up alarm and starts to yell and scream, nothing will change.
It is my observation that frequent cell phone users have lost their analytic thinking ability. I don't think that's a joke, but that's a serious question. Maybe people are laughing a little nervously, but are there any comments on that question?
There is one study I'm aware of that suggested that those people who are exposed to cell phones for a brief period compared to those who are not did a memory-type task much faster but made more errors. So if you can draw an inference from that, maybe that will answer the question.
Here's a question to Dr. Moskowitz. What about astrocytomas?
Astrocytoma is another name for glioma, which is another name for brain cancer. There's multiple different names for gliomas or brain cancer.
Here are two questions about medical radiation. As you know, a lot of medical diagnostic equipment now uses radiofrequency radiation, for example, MRIs. First question. What are your feelings about using diathermy, inferential current, ultrasound, and electrical stimulation in the physical therapy field in terms of EMF exposure?
Everyone's looking at me, but I don't know the numbers. The numbers are known. They're published, and I guess one could look them up and find it. And I guess as an addendum to an answer to an earlier question, I think one of the things one can do about being exposed everywhere is to get a reasonable meter and find out where you're exposed greatest. And so find areas that can serve as kind of an oasis. There may be places that you can find respite and try and seek them out and, of course, avoid the hot spots.
Dr. Sam Milham will be talking later, but if you read his book, Dirty Electricity, you'll see that things such as diathermy and so on have been shown to be a risk for many things, not the least of which is Lou Gehrig's disease.
Remember, too, the intensity of the radiation that you're receiving is a function of the distance from the source. And it's not just the distance, it's the square of the distance. So I would focus on those sources that are closest to me and get them farther away from me, like your own router and your cordless phones and things like that.
Why have them?
Or eliminate them. Yeah, fine. But those are probably going to create more harm for you than sources that are farther away.
Regarding the radiation from repeated mammograms, not all women are comfortable being exposed to this procedure. One alternative is MRI. Are there risks in having MRIs?
I have an email tagline that says, if we do not look, we cannot find. And I think this is national policy. As far as I know, there have been no studies.
Is there any data for desktop or laptop computers related to cancer?
If we do not look, we cannot find.
I think the new readers that are coming out are pretty much like the laptops, and I think one has to be very careful about the readers in terms of getting models that, or not holding them when they're downloading. I think the downloading time is the bad time for the reader, having the reader in your lap.
I'm going to close with a question which really is a statement, and you don't have to answer unless you want to, but somebody asked this very good question. How do any and all of us and the experts suggest we get to President Obama with the science? That's an open question.
The power of our love, the power of our intention.
I think one of the ways began in San Francisco, and that is every city needs to start passing some regulations. And if anybody is from cities you think that might happen, see me afterwards.
Okay, everybody, we have to take a break now, unfortunately. We're running late, and also we've been told we need to actually vacate the premises sooner than we thought by 20 minutes. So we're really running late. We'll take, instead of a 10-minute break, we'll take a 7-minute break. So come back here at, what time do you have now?
It's 2:30.
So at 2:37.